On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
But what about the promise
to build the wall and make Mexico pay for it? What about the promise?
There's no longer an onus for the candidates to take substantive stands.
Nobody knows where the Republican Party is going to land. I mean, it's kind of like a country road. No one knows where it will end.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleinman, and you're listening to Good Food.
I grabbed a handful of leeches and I put them behind my back, and I said to the producer, I said, you know, I'll eat anything. And he goes, oh, yeah, that's nice, that's nice. And I took the leeches and I threw them in my mouth. They were live. And within 3 weeks, I was on Hollywood Boulevard, 3 or 4 in the morning, which looked like an audience of parolees. You know, I was eating dehydrated cow shit and leeches and cow brains and all these things, and it didn't really affect me.
That's Matthew Biancanello talking about the competitive eating he did before finding his way to the craft cocktail movement in L.A. Back in 2008, Matt didn't even know how to make a cosmopolitan. Now his repertoire includes a 15-ingredient Bloody Mary and concoctions that feature uni and emu eggs. He's compiled his favorite recipes in a new book called Eat Your Drink. Hey, Matt, it's so great to have you here.
Thank you so much. Amazing intro.
You kind of found yourself. You know, you were one of those guys who kind of knocked around.
Yes, absolutely.
You were a competitive eater.
Yeah. I always fantasized of doing like the 100 Nathan's hot dogs in Coney Island because my father grew up there. But I was more into eating disgusting things, and I really did it for money. My brother held the Guinness Book of World Record for being covered by the most bees. And I went to this stunt that he was doing, and he was going to be covered by, like, I don't know, 20,000 leeches, and he was going to get paid $10,000. I said, wait a second. That's the easiest money anybody could make.
So the Neverland Ranch part.
Well, my brother was the director of Michael Jackson's Zoo. So I was living in Santa Barbara, and I was working for Jacques Cousteau's original producer. My brother worked in Neverland. He said, I need you to pick up these rattlesnakes from me at the airport. And I don't know if you ever saw that movie, The Freshman, with Marlon Brando.
Yes.
That's what I felt like. Like, it was all these exotic animals that I was picking up. You know, here I had a black spitting mamba. Even though it was in a wooden crate next to me, I was scared to hell. I'm driving 3 hours, going down from LAX all the way up to San Ynez, carrying this black mamba. So I did that several times for him. He did a lot of things for TV and movies. So I remember for Dr. Dolittle 2, we had this 18-foot alligator that we had to go on. And my brother said, don't worry. It's the winter time. Their metabolism is really slow, so they won't really grab you. I said, okay. Sure enough, I mean, that thing was whipping around. I mean, it was unbelievable. We had Michael Jackson's 300-pound green anaconda on The Tonight Show. The most fascinating thing was when I had to do a rattlesnake movie with him. And it was some kind of horror film. I think Treat Williams was in it. And we had to suture the rattlesnake's jaws together. They wanted the rattlesnakes to be striking. You had to get them to strike without opening their mouths. But I got to the point with him where I was, like, filming albino cobras, like, closer than we are right now. I mean, it was very, really amazing. So my brother is amazing, amazing with animals and has no fear. At one point, he owned 55 venomous snakes himself. I think he had the largest collection in the United States.
How bizarre. No wonder you needed a drink.
Well, what did I need? An expression. I needed some expression. It wasn't getting out, so I put it through the drink.
Do you remember the first drink that you put together where you felt like you had put on, like, just a suit of comfortable clothes, where you said to yourself, this is who I am, this is what I'm meant to do?
Definitely. I will say this for a fact, that it's the Last Tango in Modena. It's the strawberry balsamic vinegar drink with the Saint Germain foam. And I remember, because all these cocktails and even the cocktails based on classics, they really are based on a formula for the most part. And if you want to just say something that's mixed with citrus and sugar, is really based on the daiquiri. You have rum, you have sugar, and you have citrus. If you switch out the rum and you put tequila, you have a margarita. If you put mint in, you have mojito. If you take out and put gin, you've got a gimlet. So there is that certain formula that really has carried through a lot of what I do. And the Last Tango broke that rule. I didn't use any sugar and I didn't use any citrus. I just used aged balsamic vinegar and I used gin. And I remember seeing Vincenzo Marinella, the great bartender. He had been at Providence. He was kind of a silent mentor to me. I never worked with him, but he was somebody early on that I really looked up to. And I said to him, I said, how am I going to make this foam? I said, I don't understand this gelatin and all these things. It doesn't even really look good. He goes, well, when I was at Providence, I made a Grand Marnier pomegranate foam, and all you have to do is just, it's sweet enough, just add the egg whites and charge it, and you'll be fine. And he goes, but you don't want to use Saint-Germain. It's too expensive. And I said, I'm going to use it. But I was lucky. I was in an environment where I was left alone. Nobody has that today. I mean, no one questioned what I did. The sales were going up. But I remember that drink because I used to have these four prostitutes. They said on there during the week that they were social workers, okay? And that they flew down to make money in Los Angeles on the weekends, right? So what I did was I had just created this drink, The Last Tango. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to give four different versions to these prostitutes, and I'm going to see if they select the one that I think is great. And sure enough, they did. It was that first kind of validation from strangers, too. But also, that's really where the name comes from. Last Tango is the dance of the prostitutes, and then the Modena is where balsamic vinegar comes from. It's also a drink that I feel like everyone is pretty much going to like.
So I remember my first experience at the Library Bar.
I do, too.
Where you almost killed me. This was pre—
But you weren't driving, were you?
Pre-Uber, pre-Lyft. That multi-course pairing, like, blew me away. Oh. And I remember the Lost in Laos.
Mm-hmm.
Describe that drink and the narrative that goes along with it.
Well, I always loved Thai food, and I was really wanting to create that soup, the Tom Kha Kai. It has vodka, kefir lime, coconut milk, and lemongrass. It's more of a winter drink because that's when the kefir limes are around. But what I remember, and which you really were the impetus to this, is when you came in and I gave you the Breeder's Cup, the beet horseradish drink, you're like, this is like Passover in a glass.
Yeah, I said you should call it the Jew.
Yeah. So every Jew that comes to me who doesn't like Bloody Marys, I'm like, Evan Kleinman said that this is Passover in a glass. And they'll take a sip and be like, that's exactly what it tastes like. So it's pretty funny.
One of the things that you do a lot is you create your own infusions.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, you brought a bottle.
I did. I brought you because the Pimm's cup is in there.
Now, describe what just a Pimm's cup is.
Well, Pimm's is a gin-based spirit with other herbs and botanicals and vermouth. I never liked the actual Pimm's. I never felt like it had enough flavor. And then I started infusing it. The things that I love to put in that was like rhubarb and strawberries and avocado leaves. I love just muddling ginger and a little bit of agave and lime juice and cucumbers and mint. The whole process is really like, okay, this is the formula, but change it 10 to 12 times a year from what's either in your garden or what's in the farmer's markets. I actually gave you a winter citrus one. You have stinging nettle and grapefruit blossom infused Pimm's cup.
Are you ever going to find a place? It's like, for those of us who love what you do, you're sort of like this moving target that one has to constantly sort of find out where you are to get to drink what you do.
There's only two concepts that I would do. I would either do have a kitchen and everything comes out of the kitchen, because that might be my next pop-up, where people have come and it's eight courses of liquid and it's a menu and you can have supplements and you can go spirited or not, and it will all come out of the kitchen in beautiful courses. I feel like I need to do that before I move on. So I fluctuate between that and my 8 to 10 seat bar that I just want people to come, do three seatings a night, and blow their minds every night.
It is always so great to talk to you. Thank
it's
you, Matt.
It's never enough time. Thank you so much.
That's Matt Bianconello. His new book is Eat Your Drink. You can find instructions for how to make his Lost in Laos cocktail, it's one of my favorites, on the Good Food blog. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. And while we're on the subject of local ingredients and foraging, let's see what Laura Avery has in the works at the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. I'm speaking today with Nick Irvin, who is the executive chef at Fundamental on Westwood Boulevard. Nick, you're here at the market today. We're excited about spring. What are you shopping for?
I am here for treviso, which is one of my favorite vegetables ever.
Let's explain what that looks like.
It's sort of lettuce that is purple, and it's bitter, and it's delicious, and it's awesome with anything acidic.
Bitter in the way that, say, for example, radicchio is bitter?
Exactly.
Okay, and when you say lettuce, is it, it's a long-leafed, like a romaine?
It looks like a purple romaine, if you will.
Okay, so what's the technique for preparing it?
At my restaurant, at Fundamental, we soak it overnight in some black garlic and soy sauce and vinegar. The acid really cuts down a lot of that bitterness. And then we char that on on a plancha, and we serve that with on top of green goddess dressing with papadou peppers and cotija cheese. And it sounds crazy, but the salad, it tastes like pizza, which is the best kind of salads are the salads that taste like pizza.
Right, those ones where you don't have to just put the salad on top. The whole piece is a salad.
The whole thing is delicious.
And so you soak it overnight. Doesn't that make it limp?
A little bit, but it's such a hearty vegetable that it really stands up to a lot of things that you can do to it.
And since it's been soaking all night, do you oil it first before you char?
No, it goes straight on the plancha, and caramelizes pretty quickly.
And what is the plancha?
Think of a plancha like a griddle.
Okay. And the black garlic, what is that?
Black garlic is fermented garlic. So it's imagine like pure kind of umami, unctuous umami. That's really what it is. It's a great, just rich flavor.
How do you make your green goddess?
Our green goddess is avocado-based. We puree avocado with anchovy and tarragon and basil and some creme fraiche and a little bit of parsley. And it's really, it's super vibrant and bright. And it's very springtime.
Obviously, you're going to have more and more stuff coming. The fruit is coming in, so we're going to hope that we're going to see you and hear more about great dishes and applications of your amazing homemade salad dressing, too.
Yeah, I'm excited. I'm here every Wednesday.
Thank you so much, Nick.
Thanks a lot.
That was Nick Irvin, and he's the executive chef at Fundamental, enjoying the market here, doing pairing with bitter vegetables and homemade dressings, making pizza salad. You can find Treviso at numerous stands here at the market. Right now, though, we're talking with Romeo Coleman from Carpinteria, who has Treviso. You've also got that radicchio there, Romeo, and you're, of course, well-known for growing all kinds of greens. But tell us about your Treviso and why you grow it and how it grows.
We grow it because customers wanted it. It gets a beautiful big head, and we usually try and leave the outside leaves on it. They're a little green. People think it's something else, but we take off the outer leaves, and they see the red, really deep red, and they recognize it as a radicchio or a Treviso.
And they're all in the same, is that the chicory family?
They're all in the same family as escarole, endive, dandelions.
Yeah, and they're all slightly bitter, and I suppose they're very good for you.
Yeah, they have that general bitter flavor, brings a different element into your game.
Right. And I think some people not only eat it raw, Chef Nick Irvin said he was going to grill it. What other ways can you eat it?
You can eat it raw. You can barbecue, grill it like that. One of our favorite ways to use it, we cook some bacon. Take the bacon out, leave a little bit of grease in there, have it chopped up, wilt it in there. Then add it together with some blue cheese to let that melt a little bit. And the bacon, blue cheese, oh, it's great.
Sounds like heaven. And is the Treviso, is that just a special variety that's seasonal?
We actually plant it year-round, almost year-round in succession with our lettuce. So it goes on the same timeline as our lettuce. It takes a little longer to mature, but that way we have it almost year-round.
Yeah. And is it the sun that makes the outer leaves green and the inner leaves are protected, you know, by the outer leaves?
I'm not sure exactly the scientific reason behind that, but you'll notice when the plant gets more mature, then definitely the inside hearts are definitely more red, and with the white ribs, it's really a nice contrast.
And how big do they get? Do you try to harvest them at the same size?
It depends on the time of season. In the middle of winter, the stuff coming through the fall tends to stay a little smaller. Beginning of fall is nice and big. Springtime is nice and big. But then in the springtime, you also got to watch out for the ones that are starting to flower.
Right, they start to bolt.
Yeah, they start to bolt and they get a hard central stalk, but there's still a lot of leaves on it that are useful and still have the great color and the texture and taste.
Romeo, do you start from seedlings or from seeds?
Since we grow organically, we start from transplants. It takes a while for them to germinate, and we get a jump ahead of the weeds in the field with that, starting by transplant.
Okay. And how are they harvested? You just take a knife and cut them off at the soil?
Similar to lettuce, we cut it at the base of the soil and then trim off some of the bottom leaves and then pack it in the boxes, crates, wash it up, and bring it to market within 24 hours.
Wow. yeah, it looks absolutely vibrant. Yes, beautiful. Thank you, Romeo.
Thank you, Laura.
That was Romeo Coleman. He's the farmer at Coleman Family Farm, and their stand is just legendary for the staggering amount of greens they grow, and they're beautiful, of course, the radicchio and the treviso. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
You can find Nick Irvin's recipe for how to make warm treviso salad with cotija cheese and pepperdew peppers on the Good Food blog. Next, we move to a pink wine that's all the rage again this year. Stay close.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Santa Monica-based public radio station KCRW relies on the support of its listeners. One way to help is by donating your old car, truck, boat, or motorcycle. We'll pick up the vehicle from anywhere in the country. Put your old ride to good use and take advantage of a great tax write-off. Visit kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. What do Instagram star The Fat Jewish and Brangelina have in common? Rosé, apparently. They even have their own rosé labels, White Girl Rosé and Miraval, respectively. There must be a need for all this pink. A couple summers ago, headlines suggested that the rosé supply was running dangerously low in the Hamptons. Uh-oh. But does this wine live up to the hype? Bon Vivant and wine man Lou Amder is here to talk shop. So, Lou, tell us how you really feel about the return of rosé season. Are you looking forward to it, or are you rolling your eyes?
No, I love rosé, and I love that people love rosé. Sommeliers, as wine buyers of all sorts, myself included, are susceptible to fads, to trends, to grappling with traditions that are fragmented and trying to sew them back together, at least in our own practice. That's our own desire and our own discourse. And the consumer is maybe sometimes knows about the discourse, but it's sort of marginal to them. When you eat in a restaurant, it's a very kind of privileged context to serve someone wine. And it's a very constrained context in a sense. In a retail setting, it's a little different in that you have many more contexts with which to serve people wines they may find interesting. And in Los Angeles, of course, it's hot a lot. Last summer, I found it was punishingly hot. Good rosé is first and foremost something that's refreshing and in most cases has good acidity. Most cases, at least the kinds of rosés that I really dig, are dry, although I do love sweet rosés too. We'll talk about that in a second. But the key thing about rosé, I think, in many, many contexts, whether are you eating something specifically, are you dining outside, are you going to a party, are you having a party, there's so many different contexts with that rosé makes sense in Los Angeles that I'm thrilled that people are drinking refreshing, albeit simple wines a lot of the time.
Except for Beaujolais, I think of it as a seasonal wine more than any other. And it's interesting because just listening to you talk about New York, one wonders if the extremeness of the craze is because they're just so grateful when warmth comes that they get to have this beverage that brings spring along with it.
Sure. And again, living in Los Angeles, we don't really have that constraint most of the year. Rosé is something, of course, we can drink a lot of the time in Los Angeles, and a lot of times I want something refreshing and simple and thirst-quenching, and rosé fits the bill all year round, especially when it's warm out. A lot of the food that I like to eat, a lot of other people like to eat when it's hot out, goes great with rosé. So again, it's that food context. Rosé is refreshing because in good rosé, you have acidity. Mouth-watering acidity. It's the same reason why we like lemonade. It's refreshing. Same reason why we like soda, because the carbonic acid in soda is itself an acid. Of course, it eats away your teeth. But acid is the most important aspect of a white wine that makes it refreshing.
And then the lack of tannin.
Yeah, for sure. Now, some rosés have tannin. A little bit of tannin is not going to harsh your vibe at all. it's that telltale thing of having something that is light-bodied, does not have a lot of extract, that does not have a lot of tannin or no tannin at all, that makes it extra refreshing as well.
So what foods does it go best with?
It depends on the rosé. A rosé that you might want on Thanksgiving could be different than a rosé you want when it's 98 degrees out and 90% humidity. Of course, all kinds of seafood go great with these sort of beverage high acid, simpler rosés, where you're not really looking for a wine that's going to like curl your toes or like really blow you away. You want to be there in the moment with the fish. You don't want the wine to hog the spotlight.
And that's what beverage means.
To me, yeah. If a simple rosé, a $12 or $14 retail rosé, manages to leave you happier and leave you refreshed after you've been schlepping around in a hot, dusty day in your car, that's a good thing. It did a good thing for you.
Rosé's made all over the world, but for the ones we really want to drink, are we still looking towards Provence?
Rosé really came into its own in Provence. Some of the best rosés in the world, Bandol Rosé, is a Provençal rosé. I think we really have to look to Provence as sort of setting an archetype for one type of rosé. But there's rosé happening all over the world, even all over France. The Loire Valley is a place where interesting and delicious, not extortionately priced rosés are being made from Gamay, from Gros Lot, from all sorts of indigenous red grape varieties that are unique to the Loire, Pinot de Nice, for example. Not a tradition in the Loire, unlike Provence, to make rosé. Beaujolais, also in France, a place where there's some simple, inexpensive Gamay rosés being made. Here on our own shores, I think the rosé scene is really changing dramatically. When I started in the wine trade professionally about 12 years ago, there were just a handful of California rosés that I really wanted to drink. Today, there are many more. People like Hank Beckmeyer making delicious, inexpensive, crisp, dry rosés from the material that he has available to him in the Sierra foothills. There's a whole range of interesting California rosés that I think are surprising and sometimes made from unusual grape varieties. Arno Roberts makes a fabulous rosé out of Torriga Nacional, which is a red variety used to make port. Getting back to the old world, unexpected places like the south of Germany make lovely rosés out of a grape called Trollinger. You know, it's interesting about Trollinger. I don't really think that lighter-bodied reds are necessarily a replacement for rosé, but there are a lot of really light-bodied red wines that can function like a rosé. So light-bodied reds from the Alto Adige in the northeast of Italy made from a grape called Schiava. In the Loire Valley, getting back to the Loire, there's grapes like Gros Lot that are only capable of making these 11.5% alcohol wines. From the Jura, Pulsar, another red grape, 12% alcohol is pretty much the norm for that. So these light-toned, low-tannin, fresh red wines that can really function like a rosé as well. You look at it, it's like, is it a dark rosé? You don't know, really. These are lightly infused wines, not extracted wines that can be served cool and are fun to drink in the summer, too.
What is the appropriate temperature to serve these kinds of wines?
With this simple beverage category rosé that I've been yammering on about, I think serving them ice cold is appropriate. I don't know about you, but when it's really hot, I love having super cold things to drink. More complex rosés that have a little bit of age, and some rosés can age, you don't want to serve them ice cold. Lighter-bodied red wines, it depends. I've had in France Beaujolais served shockingly cold, which is kind of fun because then as the wine warms up, it changes and you change. So you almost have like a momentary aperitif of this crisp, super cold, shockingly cold red wine, and then it warms up and it's a new wine. So that's kind of fun as well. For Beaujolais, I like my Beaujolais fairly cool, around 55 degrees or so. The wines I mentioned from the Alto Adige and the Jura, 55 I think is a good temp for those as well.
It is always such a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks for having me on.
We've been talking to Lou Amdor about rosé. Ask him your questions in person at Lou Wine Shop and Tastings in Los Feliz. Next, we move to a refreshing aperitivo that has roots in Italy. Stay tuned.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcast you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join. And thanks.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. The last time I was in Venice, Italy, I felt like every bar was part of a conspiracy to get me to drink more spritz. The Aperol and Prosecco-based drink was everywhere. I can't remember a time or place so spritzed up since L.A. in the 1980s when my mom and her friends drank white wine spritzers like it was their passport to upper-class dining. But how was this classic aperitivo born, and how did it come to symbolize La Dolce Vita in Italy? I posed these questions to writers Talia Bayocchi and Leslie Parisot. Behind the wheel of a Fiat, they recently drove the Northern Italy Spritz Trail and wrote a book about it. It's called Spritz. Welcome, ladies.
Thank you.
Hi.
It was really the most bizarre experience because I've been traveling to Italy for almost 40 years regularly. But there was something about the ubiquity of that drink being everywhere that just really caught me by surprise.
Yeah, as Americans, we're sort of taught that doing the same thing twice is like, why would you do that? We're looking for variety. And the thought of everyone simultaneously in one city showing up at the same time and drinking the same drink is hard to imagine. But there it is literally at 6 p.m. in Venice. Everyone is drinking a spritz.
So what is the history of a spritz? Is it long or is it a fairly modern concoction?
Well, it really depends on how you define the spritz. The act of adding water to wine goes back to Greek and Roman times. You know, the Greeks used to mix seawater with wine to flavor it, or honey, or, you know, rose. There was a wine in present-day Campania that was called Sétine that was mixed with snow to dilute it. So that practice has been around for a long time. But really, the modern spritz sort of is born in northern Italy during the Habsburg domination, if you believe the tale that Italians love to tell. And it isn't really until the first decades of the 20th century that the spritz gets its sparkle, where soda water becomes widespread in northern Italy.
And that happens because of this funny little machine that allows you to carbonate the water instantly.
Precisely, the soda siphon.
And was it originally just white wine and soda?
Mm-hmm. It wasn't until the 20s and 30s that the bitter makes its way into the spritz. And the addition of the bitter to the spritz is not only an improvement on the original formula, but it really is an expression of nationalism, of Italianism. It's the Italians making this drink that was originally inherited under imperialist rule their own.
And when you say bitter, do you mean actual bitters or do you mean amaro?
Bitters. So amaro is typically a category that's associated with digestivi, so after a meal. And there are a whole nother set of bitters that are associated with the front end of a meal called aperitivi. And these are aperitivo bitters. So they're different. They're typically red or orange or yellow, as opposed to amari, which are darker in color, usually brown, black. So in a way, the color of these things sort of give you a clue as to when they're supposed to be consumed.
Before this cocktail came on the scene, weren't some aperitivi and digestivi seen as being rather medicinal?
They were, especially in Torino. There was sort of this mixture of cafe culture with the drinking culture. And in those places, a lot of times you would find bitters under the guise of medicine. We think of medicines as sort of a bitter pill. We call them bitter. And then they started to mix them into their drinks because the Italians, as they always have been, are obsessed with digestion. Medicine, obviously, has the connotation of being able to help you digest. So what better way to start digestion but to start the meal with a bitter drink and to end it with a bitter drink?
When was the moment where the classic spritz that we understand today came into being?
Really in the 1990s, in the late 1990s, in the beaches near Venice, the Prosecco ice soda water Aperol formula is born in this area. And Aperol sees what's happening in the beaches and looks at this formula and says, okay, well, we're going to standardize this, turn it into a 3-2-1 recipe and market it throughout Italy. And before that, the spritz, it's not a recipe. In researching it was difficult because it's not something where you find a recipe like you would for old American cocktails in a book, because it was really just a perspective on the aperitif. It wasn't a recipe really until the late 1990s and the early 2000s.
What role did the rise of Prosecco have in this?
Huge role. Prosecco became a lifestyle brand in and of itself. And really they call, you know, poor man's champagne. It was a way that people could access this celebratory beverage with a limited budget. And so these two things were really working in tandem at that time.
Was there a prototypical Amaro? Like, was it always Aperol straight from the beginning?
Each city and each region has its own perspective on the bitter. So when we were in Venice, we saw a lot of Select. It's a red bitter. It's got a little bit more sugar and raspberry flavor than an Aperol does. Aperol is sort of associated with that bitter orange flavor. And it's actually making a really big comeback right now. We'll soon find it in the United States if you haven't seen it yet. As you start to travel west, you find things like Aperol, more in Padua. Campari is the biggest thing in Milan. And this is because these are the places that these aperitivi were being produced. So in the same way that you find Carbonara or Cacio e Pepe in their respective cities, you're finding a red bitter that is unique to each place as well.
And given that Italy loves to ritualize everything, is there a ritualized way of assembling the drink?
There is. It's sort of like an assembly line, and nobody's using a jigger. The spritz does not ask you to use a jigger. It does not ask for measurements. At any bar, you'll find a bartender line up a dozen glasses at once, and at the same time that they're pouring a red bitter, they're also spraying soda and Prosecco in at the same time.
And does the ice go in first?
It's generally Prosecco, then bitter, and then soda. So bottom Prosecco, then the bitter, then the soda, but ice in first.
And do they stir, or do they want it to sort of meander through?
They stir very lightly, but they're very particular about that. They do not want to dissipate the bubbles because the bubble, the effervescence, is the most important part of the spritz.
Mm-hmm. What I found so surprising in Venice was just Aperol, because when I think of all of the bitters, Aperol to me is kind of the least interesting.
It's a great starting point. Aperol is one of the least bitter of the red bitters. And it's a great entry point if you haven't tried a bitter before. It can be an off-putting taste if you're not used to bitter things and you haven't had an Amari before. We also are really big fans of Cappelletti, which is a mixture of bitter and sweet. It's sort of a headier, more viscous type of red bitter, which is another great way to hop into the bitter category.
What town is that from?
It's popular in Brescia, not too far from Milan. And their spritz is essentially just still white wine, Cappelletti, and soda. So they don't use Prosecco there.
So interesting. The modern spritz now that we see in our craft bars, is it a development that has come from the white wine spritzer, or has it come in whole cloth from Italy as the Aperol spritz?
From Italy. I mean, the white wine spritzer, I think a lot of craft bartenders want to forget that, along with, you know, things like the sex on the beach. It goes simultaneously with the interest in Amaro, the rise of the Negroni. And it was really a matter of time before the spritz was appropriated as well. And now bartenders are riffing on that and creating a whole new category of cocktails that are bitter and bubbly and low alcohol.
How is the Americano different from the spritz?
The Americano does not have a wine base. It's simply Campari, sweet vermouth, and soda. It's definitely an Italian cocktail, but it's more on the cocktail side than it is necessarily the wine side.
And is it called an Americano because they thought we couldn't handle our gin?
No one really knows why it's called Americano, and everyone has a different theory on why that is. Some people say it is because something that was better suited to the American palate. Who knows what it really was?
The base of that word is amer, which means bitter in Italian. You can add cano on it, and you've got a nice little Italianism.
And what about some of your favorite non-classic iterations of this cocktail?
We're really big fans of what Natasha David in New York does. She's part owner of a bar called Nightcap. And Natasha was the first person that took the spritz and ran with it in a very avant-garde way. She does everything from infusing sherry with chilies and then mixing it with a wine base. She likes to infuse. So often you'll find a vermouth that has basil in it, and then layered upon that are flavors that don't necessarily impede upon the spritz but augment it. She is also involved with a group called the Proprietors LLC, which have many bars here in LA. And Alex Day, who is sort of their cocktail wizard, is a great fan of the spritz as well. And he is somebody who's innovated in ways like putting spritzes on draft. So you can, on any day, go into their bar called the Normandy Club and find a spritz coming right out of a tap like you would a beer or a wine these days.
So you can have that as your aperitif before you go next door and have a burger at Cassell's?
Yeah, that sounds like exactly what we're going to do after this.
That's so funny. When I look at recipes, like food recipes, I'm always really fascinated by incremental changes, like the move from like pancake batter to Yorkshire pudding, mm-hmm. to, you know, something more solid like a muffin. Mm-hmm. With the spritz, is there another place it goes? So you have the spritz, you have an Americano, and then you have the Negroni. Is there something in between or something in the next step?
There's the Negroni Spagliato,
I've never had a Negroni Spagliato. That means like a wrong Negroni.
Exactly.
A mistaken Negroni. There's a great bar in Milan called Bar Basso. And the story is that the second owner of the bar, a bartender, mistakenly grabbed the Prosecco bottle instead of the gin bottle and created what is called now the mistaken Negroni. Essentially, it's a Negroni, but instead of gin, there's Prosecco. It's sweet vermouth, Campari, and Prosecco.
The great thing about Bar Basso is in case you were worried about not having quite enough alcohol, they serve it in a basically a flower vase, more or less. It's a glass that's about the size of a pineapple. So that, I guess, is the halfway point between an actual Spagliato and a Negroni because it is supersized.
Which is so un-Italian.
Yeah. In Bar Basso, there are people that are holding this giant goblet in their hands after work, and they also serve the Negroni in that same glass.
It's a great marketing campaign.
Yeah.
What fun it's been to have the two of you here. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Talia Baiocchi and Leslie Parisot. Their new book is Spritz, Italy's most iconic aperitivo cocktail. The Spritz may begin a meal in Italy, but an Amaro bookends the experience, working as a digestivo. That's where we're going next when our program continues.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. KCRW relies on member support to help keep our programming fresh and authentic. Find out how you can donate at kcrw.com/join.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Amari, the plural form of the singular amaro, are often used as the bitter ingredient in a spritz. But an amaro can also be enjoyed on its own at the end of a meal. Recipes for the liqueur start with herbs, roots, and flowers, but full ingredient lists are not typically shared by their makers. Here to illuminate us is Sarah Clark. She's beverage director for the Mozza Restaurant Group, where 50 amari stock the bar. Hi, Sarah.
Hello, Evan.
How did you fall in love with amaro?
Well, I've known about them for years, but then certainly working with Mozza deepened my appreciation for amari. And it's just really the completing experience where you start kind of with a spritz or prosecco or something like that in an Italian meal, and then you kind of round out your experience always with amari.
There's such a huge arc, I guess, of different flavors and accessibility of the amaro. Some are super bitter, some are less bitter. Mm-hmm. So maybe you could take us through a little collection that starts easy and simple and ends more complex.
Okay. Well, the first one I would start with would be Amaro Montenegro from Bologna. It's not too bitter. It's not too dry. It has some really nice elderflower notes for people that like Saint Germain and things like that. But it's great, and it's great in cocktails. So I would start with something like that. You could also do Amaro Nonino, which is from Friuli. A little bit more viscosity and so forth than Amaro Montenegro, but also kind of really good, really well-balanced, really kind of easier drinking than some.
The Amaro Nonino is very much lighter in color than a lot of Amaro one sees. Why is that?
The aromatizing agents and what they use, as well as the sweetness. Sometimes that can make it darker as well.
Are most of them meant to be drunk on their own, neat, in a little glass? Or are some Amaro makers these days taking into consideration the fact that they're going to be used in cocktails?
Well, so many of these are older recipes. So I don't think that they started with thinking about cocktails, but it's really a great component for cocktails now. Not always the base spirit, but it'll really add really nice layers to a cocktail, herbaceousness and maybe a little bit of bitterness to offset sweetness that brings a complexity to a cocktail that's really great.
How do we go about evaluating an Amaro when it comes to bitterness, sweetness, color and flavor? And do they have terroirs like wine does?
You know, it all starts with a neutral spirit, generally grape-based neutral spirit.
When you say a neutral grape spirit, should we think grappa?
Mm-hmm. Often, yes. Some are wine-based. There's a few other little caveats, but generally something like grappa or grappa. And then it's kind of based on producer and also style. Like, for instance, some of the Northern Alpen Amari are drier, darker, more bitter, more intense.
Really intense.
Yes. A lot of the kind of Fernet-style Amari and things like that that you'll find up there.
It's almost medicinal.
Yes, but for good purpose of digestion.
Yeah, and it definitely works. I mean, it really does work.
It does.
I notice when I'm traveling, if I'm really traveling a lot and moving, like my body is actually moving through space mm-hmm. a lot, and I'm going to different villages and up and down in elevation, I have to say that there's nothing that settles me down better than like a strong Amaro.
I absolutely agree.
When we look at something like Fernet Branca, what does the Branca mean?
Branca is the house, and then Fernet is the style. So there's, gosh, I don't know how many Fernet style Amari there are, and there seem to be more and more all the time. But Fernet Branca is definitely the classic.
Are there more and more all the time because there are new makers entering the market, or are we just discovering these little hidden gems everywhere?
I think it's both. I think that Fernet has gone up in popularity so much that importers are looking for Fernet to import. I mean, I also know that there are people that are making it. There's Fernet Francisco in San Francisco that was based on just the demand and appreciation of Fernet in San Francisco.
So you mentioned Montenegro as being a good place to start,
mm-hmm.
and an Alpine Fernet style as being probably the most challenging.
Mm-hmm.
What are some in the middle that you think we could enjoy?
There are some very interesting product-based, meaning a specific ingredient that you could try in the middle. Chinar is one that's really popular that's an artichoke-based Amari. Averna has blood orange and other things. I mean, they're all blended with other things, but they have a kind of a primary ingredient in them. Ramazzotti is another one that would be good. These are all kind of mid-range Amari. They're a little darker, a little drier, not quite as intense as the Alpine Amari, but a little bit more complexity than you would find in some of the more, the lighter style Amari.
And are these middle styles the kind that we would want to use for cocktails?
Oh, you certainly can. You know, we make some very refreshing cocktails with Averna and Maletti.
Aside from the spritz, which we heard about earlier in the show, what are some other cocktails that are a great use of Amaro?
Well, especially if you're starting in Amaro, one of the ones that I personally enjoy, especially like on a hot summer day, is to use Amaro Montenegro with tonic water and a good portion of lime.
Oh, that sounds great.
Yeah, really refreshing.
Wow, I've never thought of doing that.
Yeah.
I always tend to go Negroni-esque.
Well, and there are people that will substitute, say, the sweet vermouth in a Manhattan with Averna. They call them black Manhattans.
I guess the sky's the limit these
days. Yeah, absolutely.
You brought a bunch of Amari just for us to take a look at, and in your bag was one that looks like a newer entry into the market that you said is blood orange based. Which one is that?
So this one is from Sicily, and it's called Amara. And it's fairly new to the market. We certainly keep abreast of all of the new Amari coming into the market and try them all, and that's how we have such an extensive collection. But this one is based on blood oranges. And also a good kind of mid-range Amari.
So interesting, and a beautiful bottle.
Mm-hmm.
A lovely gift. What is the price range of most of the mid-range?
To go and buy a bottle of Amari would be anywhere from low 20s to, say, $40. So considering all that goes into it and all of the history and all of the product, a pretty good buy.
And they last forever.
They do.
Why do you think Amaro makers are so secretive?
Well, I mean, it's their baby. It's their product. It's what they love and believe in and often have made it for many, many years. And it's, you know, a family tradition. You know, just like the monks will never tell us what's in chartreuse, I imagine most of these Amari will never know.
We've been talking Amari with Sarah Clark, beverage director for the Mozza Restaurant Group. Now, let's turn to another ingredient that's exploded on the bar scene lately, bitters. We're not just talking about that decades-old bottle of Angostura with its tattered paper covering. There's a seemingly infinite library of new bitters on the market. Mark Bitterman tasted hundreds for his book, Bitterman's Field Guide to Bitters and Amari. Welcome back to the show, Mark.
Hi, how are you?
First, I'd like to ask you, how do you distinguish bitters from Amari?
Yeah, great question. Amaro is the Italian word for bitter. And so an Amaro is a bitter drink. Amari is just plural for that word. So Amari is plural for Amaro. Really, the only difference between the two is that you drink an Amaro out of a bottle and you dash bitters out of a bottle. So bitters are what you use for seasonings and cocktails and food. And Amari are what you use as a beverage.
Let's concentrate on bitters for a minute. If they're the seasoning for a cocktail, what role do they play? Are they like salt?
Yeah, I love the analogy that they're like salt for your cocktail. They sharpen flavor. They help align flavors. They actually accentuate and bring out flavors that you don't necessarily detect. And of course, they add a flavor of their own.
You categorize bitters into seven classifications. Can you quickly run through the seven groupings?
I can do my best. Aromatic is the most important. So that's like Angostura, but there are many others like Boker's and Dandelion and Burdock. These are balanced bitters that you use as your kind of all-purpose bitters. There's citrus, which is very important also. Those are kind of your salt and pepper, if you will, of your bitters. Citrus bitters, they don't have the actual juicy quality, but they have this great lemonini kind of edge that they bring to cocktails. Then, of course, you have herbal bitters. That could be celery. It could be rosemary. An herb-forward flavor of bitters is another important category. There are spiced bitters, like baking spices, clove and anise and cinnamon and things that are kind of organized into flavors that work better for kind of the warmer flavor palette. That's an important one. And then, of course, you have fruit bitters, much less common. Think about, for example, cherry or peach or pear bitters. Spiced bitters or piquant bitters is an important one. Unlike when cooking, you can just put chili peppers in something or hot sauce. Hot sauce is, of course, very salty and very vinegary. You wouldn't want to use that. So you can use piquant bitters in your drinks as well.
I can imagine a dish where I use many of those kinds of flavors to bring my ultimate dish into being. Is there a drink where you use three or four, or are you usually just using one?
For many years, I only used one at a time. And for some reason, I thought that there was some sort of a purist approach that needed to be honored. But the more familiar I become with bitters over the years, the more I started to mix them. And now it's actually, for me, almost routine. So a great example, one of my favorite things to use bitters with is I'll use a dandelion and burdock bitters in a Manhattan. But then I do a couple dashes of chocolate bitters, and it makes the whole thing come alive. It does not make the drink chocolatey in the least, but it just brings out the beautiful, rich flavors of the bourbon and marries them beautifully with the vermouth.
Can you think of an example of using a citrus and a spiced bitter together?
I think a citrus and a spice bitter could be beautiful in an old-fashioned, for example, but even in a Negroni. I think that you could take a lighter style vermouth. Normally, I make a Negroni with a Carpano Antica, really hearty, rich Italian vermouth. But you could use a much lighter, more delicate French or American vermouth and then use a baking spice bitters. But then you want to round the whole thing off and bring it back to it. It's kind of the citrus base of the Campari. So I throw some citrus bitters in there.
How many different bitters did you taste for the book?
The book actually has over 500 varieties in the book.
Oh, my goodness.
I've been collecting these bitters and selling them in my stores, and we've had them for a long time. But I had to go through every single day and tasted dozens and dozens and dozens of bitters. And as I did it, of course, I had to cleanse my palate. So I'm sitting there eating salty potato chips as I go. For about 6 weeks, all I did was drink bitters, cook with bitters, and eat potato chips. It was my gift to humanity.
And what a gift it is. When you're tasting bitters, is it straight or do you use something as a vehicle, a little bit of water?
If you're just tinkering with bitters, like in a store, or you're tasting a friend's bitters, or you're just experimenting with them at home and you want to get a handle, the simplest thing to do, of course, is just to put a drop on the back of your hand and smell it and then lick it and see what comes to you. But of course, like salt, bitters is all about its interaction with other ingredients. You don't ever eat bitters on its own. Or drink bitters on its own. I do think you do need to get a little bit of a template here and there. So sparkling water is a great starting place. But I would look maybe to what type of bitters it is. I taste aromatic bitters very often in an old-fashioned. And I'll taste a citrus or an herbal bitters very often in a martini. And that gives me a little bit more of a canvas to judge them from.
If I were to be plunked down in one of your shops, and I saw this giant array in front of me. As a person who tends to like a more bracing cocktail, often a sourish cocktail, what kind of bitters would you prescribe for me?
If you like a sour cocktail, then for sure I'd bring you, of course, into the citrus zone. I think sour cocktails, people sometimes really rely overly on sugar to bring that sourness, that tartness into balance. And I personally don't like sweet cocktails. To keep it from being overly acidic and sharp, bitters can really help round things out. So that's an important one. But you can also, like we mentioned earlier, some of these other flavors can be kind of fantastic in that. So a baking spice bitters, I love that with sour citrusy drinks. And I wouldn't actually say that it'd be a bad idea to try something entirely different once in a while, like a floral bitters. I've had certain drinks where you put in like a dash of lavender bitters or something and it actually comes off.
Aside from the bottle of Angostura, I'm familiar with certain names that have seemed to seep into stores that must have been around for years, but maybe were hidden from us, like Fee Brothers. What are some other names that you would like to get out there for people to look at and pick up and smell that you think are doing a great job of making these wide variations of bitters?
There are so many. Angostura bitters is a perfectly good bitters. It's actually a wonderful bitters. The thing is, it's actually not a good all-purpose bitters. One of my very favorite out there, and it's starting to be a little bit more widely distributed, is Dr. Adam El-Majirab, and he's out of the UK, but he makes a Boker's Bitters, which is a fantastic all-purpose bitters. If I could have one bitters in my cupboard, it would be this bitters. Down south in Southern California, there's Miracle Mile. They do some fantastic bitters, bergamots and sour cherries and some very, very useful, helpful bitters. There's 5x5. They do great products. Brooklyn Hemispherical, they do great things. Bitter Cube does amazing work. So there's really a great number, but you know the ones I just mentioned, they're absolutely fabulous at what they do.
So is the process of making bitters basically an alcohol infusion?
That is correct. The way I would technically describe a bitters is that it is an alcohol-based flavor extract. You take a bunch of botanicals, you soak them in alcohol. The ethanol of alcohol pulls out all these aromatics and flavors. Water is not as effective at removing, and many of these aromatics are not actually water soluble. So the alcohol is just how you get the flavor out. There are some bitters that are not made with alcohol. Some use other extraction techniques and often glycerin, which is a sugar. And yet others, such as Fee Brothers, they're actually just glycerin and artificial flavors, with sometimes some natural flavors too, but they definitely contain artificial flavors. And they're really just about trying to get a customer expectation where they need it.
So this idea of using glycerin, are glycerin bitters better suited to certain uses?
That is a really sharp question. Maybe you've done some reading. I would say that overall, glycerin bitters are absolutely inferior in cocktails. However, because they're not alcohol-based, their aromatics aren't as volatile, so they're great in cooking. They hold their flavor, they're bright and vibrant, they have more staying power.
So I'm a person who really is in love with the flavor of celery. Like one of my lifetime best bites of anything I've put in my mouth is this incredible celery ice cream I had once in Rome. If I were going to get a great bottle of celery bitters, what would I want to use it in?
Obviously, it's going to be fantastic in a Bloody Mary. But if you did a more botanical, like for example, you take Hendrick's gin that has that kind of cucumbery quality, a dash of celery bitters in there is going to be fantastic in a martini. You can do it in tonics and spritzes. I've even put celery bitters in certain champagne cocktails, super, super beautiful dry brut champagnes. And celery bitters is beautiful. It's wonderful in salad dressing.
What about a bowl of chicken soup?
Well, yeah. So, I mean, spot on. It's gonna bring a freshness and vibrancy. You know, alcohol is a flavor transporter. It actually helps your mouth to assimilate and appreciate flavors in a very different way, but in an analogous way to salt. A dash or two in your chicken soup's got to go fantastically.
Wow. When we're making our own bitters, is there a period of aging involved?
Yes. So when you make your own bitters, most of the recipes on the internet will tell you to steep your botanicals in alcohol for months. But what I've found to a remarkable degree is that you get almost all the flavors you want out of your botanicals in days or weeks at the most. It happens very rapidly. And when you keep your botanicals in there longer, you actually start to get a lot of these weird, off, yes, bitter flavors, but not bitter in a positive way. Muddier, darker, more brooding, less vibrant flavor.
Your book has given me so much to think about in the kitchen. I have to tell you.
Well, thank you for having me on. This is really a pleasure.
Mark Bitterman's latest book is Bitterman's Field Guide to Bitters and Amari. Now with some much-needed food to soak up all this booze, we turn to Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. Where are we headed?
We're going to Koreatown.
What are we finding there?
We're going to a really new restaurant called Chungsil Hongsil. Chungsil Hongsil apparently refers to the blue thread and the red thread that are used in Korean wedding ceremonies. It's a new noodle shop. It's a branch of a place that opened in the 60s in Incheon, South Korea. And they specialize in basically two things. One is memil, their buckwheat, and they're served the same way as soba on a bamboo mat, cold, wrapped around. And there's a broth on one side. You get some stuff to put in the broth. There's squeezy hot mustard, which I guess would be the same as the wasabi that you get with soba. And there's grated daikon.
Is it an anchovy broth?
It's definitely an anchovy broth.
Yum.
It's so good. And so you take the buckwheat noodles and you dip the ends of it or more of it if you're indelicate. You slurp it up, spraying everything within the 3-foot radius. It's really delicious.
It sounds wonderful. Are the noodles ever served warm?
You can get warm noodles, and they also serve a udon in a soup that's not so bad at all. But almost everybody seems to be getting it either cold on a mat or as something like bibimguksu, which is to say those soba noodles are in a bowl with stuff on them, chili sauce, there's julienne vegetables, there's half a lightly boiled egg, and delicious slivers of Korean pear, you know, that has that super light texture and just a delicate sweetness. And then you toss them all together and then you eat it that way.
So it's the noodle version of bibimbap. That sounds mighty good.
But the thing they have that's like way above what anybody in Koreatown is doing at the moment are these tiny little steamed dumplings, not quite sealed at the top, that are filled with minced pork and vegetables.
Are they delicate?
The skins are amazingly delicate. It's like it's one of those noodle shops that has, there's a window and then like an operating theater where you can see the guy like rolling out the dumplings. They almost dissolve in your mouth. They have just a beautiful texture. I've never had anything quite this ethereal.
So this is the kind of dumpling where you immediately have to order two orders before you begin.
Definitely. I ordered one order and it was clearly not enough. There's another kind of dumpling filled with minced kimchi and meat. They're bigger. They're like fist size, I guess. But it's a really short menu. I mean, there are 9 things on it, maybe, but you realize it comes down to 2 things.
Perfect. It's good to have focus sometimes when you go out.
Exactly.
Is this a more prevalent thing, established restaurants in Korea coming in, opening an outpost here?
I think there have to be 2 or 3 dozen of them by now. It's almost as if Los Angeles is like another suburb of Seoul.
Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Thank you.
That was Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about Chungsil Hongsil in Koreatown. Text the words good food to 69866 and you'll get Jonathan's weekly restaurant recommendations. If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen anytime you want at qcrw.com, via iTunes, or anywhere you download podcasts. You can also find Good Food on Demand on QCRW's mobile app. As always, so many thanks to the Good Food team. That is Abby Fentress-Swanson, Laurel Garcia, Camelia Tse, Joseph Stone, Joel Stein, Jillian Ferguson, Ronnie Mickelson, and Gary Messiha. Raise your glasses high. I'm Evan Kleinman, and I'll be back next week with more good food.
Salad, dry.